Good afternoon. Can you all hear okay? If not, please say. First of all, I'd like to thank Venerable Sila Wimala for the invitation to speak to you today on the subject of the Abhidhamma. I want to start by giving you some of the main characteristics of the Abhidhamma. That is all rather abstract. So then, a little bit later on, I want to take a concrete example of what the Abhidhamma can reveal to us. I think many of you already know that the Buddha's teachings have been classified by his followers into three baskets or pitakas. We have the Vinaya Pitaka, the monastic discipline, the monastic rules. We have the Sutta Pitaka, which is the discourses of the Buddha given under many different circumstances to many different people on many different subjects. And then we have the third of the baskets, which is the Abhidhamma Pitaka. The Abhidhamma Pitaka has been greatly revered over the years. In the 10th century, there was a King Kassapa V in Sri Lanka. He arranged for the texts of the Abhidhamma Pitaka to be inscribed on golden plates. And the first book, the Dhammasangani, was actually set with jewels as well. And then a century later, King Vijaya Bahu, it was his daily practice to study the Abhidhamma in the early morning before he went on to perform his kingly duties. Today, the Abhidhamma is especially revered in Sri Lanka. And trainee monks are required to learn by heart one of the commentaries on the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma consists of seven books, and in addition, there have been, or there is one particular commentary written in the 12th century, or somewhere around about that date, it may have been earlier, we don't know, by a monk called Anuruddha. And his manual of Abhidhamma has been translated into English a couple of times. Buddhaghosa, the great commentator, wrote, "Tradition has it that those monks only who know Abhidhamma are true preachers of the Dhamma. The rest, though they speak on the Dhamma, are not preachers thereof. And why? They, in speaking on the Dhamma, confuse the different kinds of karma and its results. They confuse the distinction between mind and matter and the different kinds of states or dhammas. The students of Abhidhamma do not thus get confused. Hence, a monk who knows Abhidhamma, whether he preaches Dhamma or not, will be able to answer questions whenever asked. He alone, therefore, is a true preacher of the Dhamma." applies to Ben Mosilvam. The traditional account says that in the fourth week after his enlightenment, the Buddha reflected on the Abhidhamma and its complexity and its importance. Then, tradition has it that 7 years later, he taught the Abhidhamma. He taught it to his mother as a mark of gratitude. His mother had been, well, first of all, his mother died a week after his birth and had been reborn in the Tusita heaven. That's one of the heavenly realms, the realms of the deities. And in wanting to teach the Abhidhamma, it is said that the Buddha decided it had to be taught in one day only, a complete day. The earthly days were not long enough to do that. So he had to choose one of the heavenly planes where a day was much longer, and he would teach in the Tavatinsa heaven. His mother came to the Tavatinsa heaven, and the Buddha would daily preach there, and at the time of the earthly night, he would return to the earth, and he would tell Sariputta what exactly it was that he had been teaching. And so we are grateful to Venerable Sariputta for formalizing and codifying everything which the Buddha taught. So what is Abhidhamma? Sometimes referred to as higher or special Dhamma. This means in the sense of it goes further into greater detail. There's nothing wrong or defective with the teaching we find in the suttas. But Abhidhamma goes into greater depth. And it is a very detailed analysis of both physical and mental characteristics. The difficulty of making this analysis is illustrated in the Milinda Panya, the Questions of King Milinda, where the monk Nagasena says to the king, suppose you were to take a boat out into the sea and you took in your hand some water from the middle of the sea, and then you could say, this bit of water came from the river Ganges. This bit came from the river Yamuna. This bit came from another river, and so on. Trying to do that is a very difficult thing. And that is what the Buddha has achieved in his analysis of the way the mind works and also the physical characteristics, what we call rupa. So we have many discourses in the suttas which are also having the flavor of Abhidhamma. It's not something totally different from the suttas, but there is one difference, and that is a distinction to be made between two kinds of truth. Conventional truth and ultimate truth. Conventional truth is the truth we use in everyday life. It's very necessary for us to live our lives in a meaningful way. We need to talk about you and me, and this person and that person. We talk about many things, and this was used by the Buddha in the suttas, where he was frequently talking about, I did this, or you will do that, or so forth. So conventional truth is very good, but it is not absolutely true. If, for example, we agree to meet tomorrow morning at sunrise, I think everybody knows when that will be. But actually, the sun hasn't risen. The sun hasn't gone anywhere. It's the earth that has moved. But for the sake of convention, we can talk about sunrise or sunset. We can talk, as the Buddha did, about a cow. He said, imagine a cow, and then the cow butcher or his apprentice, when they have done their work, where is the cow? You haven't got a cow any longer. It's just made up of an assemblage of bits and pieces, legs and feet and ears and head and so forth. But the cow itself was simply a conventional construction in our mind. We talk about that particular thing as a cow. And that's very useful. But we can talk about a person. We talk about an infant and then a youth and then an adult. These are all conventional terms. And in the suttas, that is the language used. But we also have ultimate truth. This means that it is no longer a question of convention. Here, the Buddha is talking about things which cannot be analyzed any further. And he said there are four ultimate truths. Citta, or consciousness. Cetasika, mental concomitants. Rupa, material form. And Nibbana. Citta is analyzed into 89 different kinds. Cetasika into 52 different kinds. And Rupa into 28. You cannot analyze any deeper or further than that. So that is why these are called ultimate truths. And that is the language of the Abhidhamma. That is one reason it is called higher teaching or further teaching. It goes further than conventional truth. But also, the Abhidhamma has a second main characteristic, which is synthesis. It analyzes things in great detail, but then also it shows that nothing exists independently or in isolation. Everything that arises, arises in dependence upon a preceding cause. And it is in turn the cause for the arising of something else. We find this doctrine of conditioned genesis, paticca samuppada, which is one of the most important of the Buddha's teachings. We find it in the Abhidhamma, but of course it's also found in the suttas as well. And then we also have conditional relations, the kind of causation, the kind of causes which can give rise to something else. And there are 24 of these conditional relations. So why should we study the Abhidhamma? The reason we study the Abhidhamma is the same as everything else in the Buddha's teachings: to obtain release from suffering. The Buddha said, "I teach just dukkha and the ending of dukkha." And that is true for Abhidhamma and for everything else. He also said, "Just as the sea has but one taste, the taste of salt," meaning wherever you take a sample from the sea, you will always get the same salty taste, "so has my teaching but one taste, the taste of deliverance." So the purpose of Abhidhamma is exactly the same as everything else that the Buddha taught. First of all, it teaches us to distinguish between wholesome states of mind and unwholesome states of mind. The words are kusala and akusala. So it teaches us to be able to recognize what are skillful and what are unskillful thought patterns. It also helps us to understand what is going on within us and in the world around us. That is where this combination of analysis and synthesis comes in. And in doing this, it gives us insight into the three characteristics of existence: anicca, impermanence; dukkha, unsatisfactoriness; and anatta, no soul or no self. And above all, I think it is the doctrine of no self which the Abhidhamma is very helpful to get us to understand this doctrine. At least we can develop what we call conceptual right view. That is an intellectual understanding of things. Of course, we then have to go on and develop experiential right view, which is what we have to do when we practice meditation. The flavor of the Abhidhamma is found already in two verses from the Dhammapada, which I'm sure many of you know very well. The first two verses: mind is the forerunner of all unwholesome states. Mind is chief, mind made are they. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, then suffering follows one as the cart follows the hoof of the draft ox. And mind is the forerunner of all skillful states. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, then happiness follows one, even as one's shadow. So that is summing up what we find in the Abhidhamma. We can say that the difference between the Sutta Pitaka and the Abhidhamma Pitaka is only one of degree, it's not one of absolute difference. And a couple of analogies. You can think of the eye seeing something, that's like the Sutta Pitaka, but when we use a magnifying glass or a microscope, then we can see in much greater detail. That is the Abhidhamma. Or the second analogy is like a medicine. On the container, we may just get the name of the medicine. That is like in the suttas. Whereas in the Abhidhamma, we get the precise formulation of the medicine. So these two are supplementary to each other. So if we... Sorry, I've lost my place here, just a second. I'm not familiar with this program. Right. Yes, so we come back to samadhiti, right understanding. The analysis that we get in the Abhidhamma shows that both physical and mental characteristics are arising and passing away millions of times in a second. We can't see this change. It takes the eye of the Buddha to see this change. But it shows us that nothing exists for more than a split second. So we can then get some insight into anicca. Change is going on from moment to moment. Nothing endures, nothing lasts. And behind this process of change, there's nothing else. There's no I or me, there's no controller, there's nobody in charge. So this also helps to understand the doctrine of anatta, the no-self doctrine. But the synthesis we get in the Abhidhamma shows us that all of these physical and mental characteristics which arise and pass away so quickly do not arise in isolation. They arise due to a preceding cause, and they themselves are the cause of something else to arise. If there were such a thing as an eternal soul or self, that would be something which did not depend upon a preceding cause, because it's eternal. But the Buddha said, as you well know, his last words were, impermanent are all conditioned things. So the Abhidhamma is also helping us to understand this nature of impermanence. There are some differences between what the Abhidhamma teaches and what we find generally in Western thought. First of all, Western thought has the concept of a personality, or a person that lasts at least from birth until death. This person exists. But the Abhidhamma says no. There's no such thing as anything which lasts for more than a moment, a split second. The second thing is that Abhidhamma is not just a theory which is the result of some speculative thinking. Many philosophies are the result of that kind of activity. But the Abhidhamma is not. The Abhidhamma is the result of the investigations which the Buddha conducted. So this is not just mere speculation. And the third difference is that the Abhidhamma gives us an ethical basis for all states of mind. It shows us which states are wholesome, which states are unwholesome, which states are causing karma, and which states are the result of karma. And that is something else you don't find generally in Western thought. So this is just what we've come across already, just to show you what leads on from this, that we have an analysis into the ultimate truths, four kinds, and the synthesis which connects all these things together in a relationship. I want to look now at one of these ultimate truths, that is citta, or consciousness. The function of citta is to cognize, is to know things. It equates to the word vijnana in the five aggregates. But whereas in the aggregates, vijnana is left without any further analysis, in the Abhidhamma, we get 89 different kinds. And they are classified in different ways. The first way is by their ethical nature. Some are moral or wholesome. The word in Pali is kusala. Kusala cittas are 21. The opposite of that is akusala, and they are 12. Kusala and akusala are what generate karma. But then we have the results of karma, called vipaka. Vipaka, number 36, and then we have what are called inoperative kriya. They are mostly found in the mind of an arahant, which is not generating karma, but is also not the result of karma. So that's why they are karmically indeterminate. Citta can also be classified according to the roots which some cittas have, which make them more strong, more powerful. We have six kind of roots, Lobha, dosa, moha, and their opposites. Alobha, adosa, amoha. So attachment, or attraction, aversion, and ignorance. And then the opposites are generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. Cittas can also be classified according to the sphere in which they arise. Buddhism recognizes 31 different planes of existence, divided into three parts. We have the sensuous sphere, the karma loka. We have the form sphere, the fine material sphere, or the rupa loka, or rupa vachara. That vachara means that which frequents, cittas which frequent the rupa planes. Above that we have the formless or arupa planes, and then we have the supramundane, that is the four paths or four stages of sainthood. If we move on to cetasika, cetasikas are the same as three of the aggregates: feeling, perception, and mental formations. There are 52 of these. They're very, very closely interconnected with the citta. They arise with citta, they perish with the citta, they have the same object as the citta, and they arise on the same plane as the citta. If you want to see a bit more detail, we have seven which are present with every state of citta, six which may be, 14 which are only present with unwholesome citta, and then we have the wholesome cittas, which are 19 beautiful ones, three abstinences, and one cetasika, which is wisdom. And then we have rupa, the third of these ultimate truths. Rupa consists of four great elements: earth, water, fire, and air, and then 24 secondary or derived elements. I just mentioned those for the sake of completeness. But I said we would take a look at one example of what the Abhidhamma can show us. So we take the what we call the process of cognition through one of our sense doors. We have five senses, external senses: eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. So what happens? What goes on when we see or hear something and we identify it as whatever we want to call it, some object? This process consists of 17 thought moments. Millions of these arise and pass away in a second. It's very fast. We start with the state of the mind, which is called bhavanga. The bhavanga state arises at the moment of conception and will continue until the moment of death. However, it is constantly interrupted by conscious thought process. So you can think of Bhavanga as like a deep and silent river, just flowing on and flowing on and flowing on. It is what we call a life continuum. This is what preserves our individual existence. We don't have a soul or a self to do that, but Bhavanga does play part of that function. So Bhavanga is flowing along, as I said, like a river, and then, let us say, something falls into the river, and it sets up a vibration. So, in this little diagram, although it says one past Bhavanga, there could be actually thousands, millions of past Bhavanga. We're not limited to one only. But on the diagram, we only have one. Then, something strikes one of our senses. And this sets up a vibration. And then this brings the flow of Bhavanga to a halt. It takes these two, number two and number three, it takes these two moments to bring the flow of Bhavanga to a halt. It is likened to somebody running. He wants to come to a stop, but he can't stop immediately. He has to take an extra one, two, three steps before he actually comes to the halt. So now the flow of Bhavanga has been arrested, and the next thing that happens is a kind of consciousness which arises in one of the sense doors. For consciousness to arise, there has to be what we call contact or fassa between the object and the sense door. And the coming together generates a kind of consciousness. So we can talk about eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, or body consciousness. This is just drawing one's attention to the appropriate sense that we have been aware of being stimulated. And then in number five, pancha means five, one of five different kinds of sense consciousness arise. So it's visual consciousness, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, or tactile consciousness. One of these kinds of consciousness arises. Still, there's no knowledge exactly what is this object. So the next stage is the receiving, the acceptance of this object, and then it is investigated. What exactly is this? And then, at stage number eight, the object is finally recognized, and a decision is made. How are we going to react to what we have just perceived? Up to this point, this has been a passive process. As long as our sense organs are working okay, we can't stop this. We can't stop the ear from hearing or the eye from seeing. But at number eight, we can determine the future. How are we going to react? So this is a very critical moment when we seize the initiative and we can, if we wish, decide to react in a particular way. A lot of the time, this moment goes past unnoticed and we just react automatically. But we can, in fact, have some measure of control. So, for example, if somebody speaks harsh or abusive language to us, we can't stop ourselves from hearing this abusive language. And we know it's abusive language. But now what are we going to do about that? At number 8, we can control our reaction. So either we can shout back with a lot more abusive language, or we can respond with patience and loving kindness and compassion and so forth. So number 8 is a very critical moment. And then following that, we have what are called jhavana moments. This is where kamma is generated. So, depending on what we did at number 8, we're now generating either wholesome kamma or unwholesome kamma. If we just shouted back with more terms of abuse, then that is unwholesome kamma that we are generating for ourselves. On the other hand, if we responded in a much more wholesome way, then the kamma generated would be wholesome kamma. And then after this, there are 2 moments of registration, which means the experience is noted and registered and put into the memory. So this process happens millions of times in a second. But this process is all there is. There isn't somebody behind it, controlling it. Somebody we can say is in charge. This is just this process of thought moments arising and passing away. Each thought moment is caused by its preceding moment and is itself the cause for the arising of the next moment. To give you an analogy, it's a story of the man sleeping on the ground underneath a tree, and his head is covered by a blanket. That is like bhavanga. Quiet, calm, peaceful. And then a piece of fruit, they call it an apple, falls from the tree and lands on the ground nearby. This sets up a vibration. Vibrating bhavanga. Then the bhavanga stops. The man is now conscious, but he doesn't really know what it is that has woken him. But he's aware that something, it was a sound. So now there is sensed or adverting consciousness to the ear. And this gives rise to auditory consciousness. That's stage number 5. So now he picks up the apple. That is the receiving consciousness. He inspects it. That is the investigating consciousness. And then he makes a decision. This apple is a good apple. I'm going to eat it. So he makes the decision at number 8, the Vatapana stage, and then the eating of the apple is what takes place in the Javana moments. And when he's finished eating the apple, he savors the taste just for a moment, just remembers the flavor of it. That is the last two, Tadalambana, the registration. And then he lies back on the ground, covers his head with the blanket, and goes back to sleep. And that is Bhavanga starting to flow again. So this process is going on in our minds the whole time. That is why we can cognize things. We can know what it is we're hearing or tasting, smelling, touching, etc. So that is one little example of how the Abhidhamma can explain to us how the mind is working. And from this we can learn a couple of things. The first is that there is nothing except constant change. There's no controller, there's no enduring person or personality behind us. All we can see is anicca, anicca, anicca. And secondly, it helps us to understand, once we've perceived something, how are we going to react? Are we going to react on autopilot? Or are we going to react in a considered way? If we operate in a considered way, we can then respond in a skillful fashion to what it is we have just perceived. So, that's just one little example of Abhidhamma. Would anybody like to ask a question? Anybody still awake? Don't hesitate to ask a question. There's no such thing as a stupid question. So, by all means, do say if there's something you would like to ask. Yes, the question is, how can it be known that these processes are going on so rapidly? And the gentleman is perfectly correct. It takes the mind of the Buddha to perceive this. We cannot see things in such detail. We don't have the power of his mind. But he was able to understand the way this system is working. And we know that there are many, many things, the Buddha said, there are many things he knew, but he didn't always teach them to us. So he was able to understand many things that we can't. And so he very kindly has given us his analysis of this particular process, the process of cognition. How can the mind know its own nature? How can the mind see itself? This is assuming that there is something which is existing like mind. If the mind exists, then it can look to see what it looks like. But all we have is this process of mental characteristics arising and passing away. Now, I haven't given you the whole story with regard to this process of cognition, because cognition can also take place through the mind door. We're not restricted only to the external senses, but if we also consider mind as a sense, then there can be an object which arises purely in the mind. It could be a memory, could be an abstract idea, some kind of original thought. But this can arise and is then processed in the same way as the process we've already looked at. So there's these 17 thought moments can take place. And that way we can determine, or at least in the first 8 of these moments, we can determine what it is. Is this state happy, unhappy, full of joy, full of anger, etc., etc.? So I think this process is just another example of this process which takes place. Does that help? Okay. You're asking, does the Bhavanga Chitta do some analysis? No, it doesn't. The Bhavanga has certain similarities with what in Western thought is called a subconscious. We cannot know what is going on in the Bhavanga. It simply is flowing on and flowing on from conception until death, until it is interrupted very frequently by some conscious process taking place in the mind. But the Bhavanga itself does not analyze anything. It is a purely passive state of mind. No, Bhavanga doesn't cognize anything. The cognition takes place through these 17 thought moments. But as with the analogy of the man sleeping, Bhavanga is a state which we experience mostly or more when we are asleep or in a coma and there's no conscious thought process going on. So the Bhavanga is what preserves our individual identity. It's called Bhava Anga. Anga is a limb, Bhava to become. So in English we call it a limb of becoming or a life continuum. We don't really have English words which correspond precisely to Bhavanga. But it is what preserves the individual identity. I think the Theravadins had a little problem. If you're not going to agree or admit to the existence of a permanent soul or self, how are you going to preserve the identity of an individual? Something has to be there to tie all things together into one individual stream. And that is the function of Bhavanga.